Carolyn has read our text in your hearing just now, and I would like for us to also consider Luke's version of that very same passage. And I want to call your attention to the bulletin inserts each of you should have in your bulletin. The various passages from the Bible that we'll use today are there, together with a short summary of the key points that we'll be making. Luke writes, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I say? I will show you what he is like who comes to me and hears my words and puts them into practice. He is like a man building a house who dug down deep and laid the foundation on rock. When a flood came and the torrent struck that house, but could not shake it because it was well built. But the one who hears my words and does not put them into practice is like a man who built a house on the ground without a foundation. The moment the torrent struck that house, it collapsed, and its destruction was complete." This is the second in a two-part series on wisdom. Last week, I talked about a passage in James. I titled it, "A Prayer That's Always Granted." And James promises us that if we ask God for wisdom, the right kind of wisdom, that we can depend on it. God will grant that prayer. Today we continue the theme of wisdom by talking not just about praying for the wisdom, but how to put it into practice. And our text today, The Wise and the Foolish Builders, I think is a good way of answering the question, where is God's wisdom when I want to put it into practice? How do I do that? Our text today, the text from Matthew, has a context, of course. It is the concluding part of the Sermon on the Mount, the longest continuous section of teachings by Jesus anywhere in the Bible. And in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus started way back in chapter 5, and then he went on through chapter 6, and now he's at the end of chapter 7. And with all the teachings that he's laid out there, he ends the sermon with three really stern warnings about taking to heart the things that he has been saying. The first picture is a picture of two roads. We're on a journey. The journey is our life. And on this journey, we can choose between two ways to travel. We can take the broad, easy way, and a lot of people are on that one. The great majority of people are taking this way, and if we follow the crowd, that's what we'll do. That way goes through a big gate in the wall, but unfortunately, on the other side, it leads to destruction. The other one's a really narrow, twisty path, kind of hard to stay on. You might have to turn side to side. And when you get to the wall of the city, well, the gate is really little. You might have to leave some stuff behind to squeeze through that gate, but it leads to life. The second picture our Lord provides is of two trees. And when it's not fruit-bearing season, they look pretty much alike. But when it's fruit-bearing season, the difference is really apparent. One bears good fruit, the other doesn't. The one that bears fruit is one which is nurtured and kept, cherished. The one which doesn't is cut down and used for firewood. The third picture is our text. It's a picture of two builders. They built their houses, they built them in different ways, and then the storm came. And today what I want to do is to talk first about the builders, then about their houses, then about the storm, and then to draw conclusions for your life and mine. Let's start with the builders then. They're called the wise and the foolish builders by Jesus. Last week, about half the sermon was devoted to figuring out what wise means in the Bible sense, because it's not identical to how we use the word in 2015. And we saw it hadn't a thing to do with IQ. It had nothing at all to do with your level of education. It had nothing to do with career cleverness. Rather, what it had to do with is good judgment. It's the ability to size up the relevant information and facts about what's available to you, the consequences it could lead to, and then make good choices. That is what wisdom is all about in the Bible. In the Bible, it also said that wise people are humble. You find the word humble with it more often than any other trait, if you just look up the word wisdom. And that's because wise people know they need help. They know they need help from others. They seek advice. They take good advice. And above all, they're interested in help from God. What about the fool? Well, the fool is the opposite. The fool may have a pretty high IQ, actually. That doesn't have anything to do with it. The fool might have a couple of PhDs. That doesn't have much to do with it. Okay. The fool might be really clever at inventing all sorts of new computer breakthroughs or what have you. That has nothing to do with it. The fool, according to the Bible, is impatient. Won't stop to really look over the situation carefully and check out all the details. The fool, according to the Bible, is also superficial. You stay on the surface. You don't like to go deep. The fool, according to the Bible, is short-sighted. Think about tomorrow, maybe, but not a year from now. You're not looking down the road at what the various things we do may lead to as we carry out our whole life. Well, that's a good Bible definition of wisdom and foolishness, but you know what? Jesus makes it even more specific, because he defines the wise person and the foolish person in his parable as, and I quote him here, the person who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice. That's what he said. The wise person heard the words of Jesus and put them into practice. What are these words of mine? Well, the Sermon on the Mount, of course. These words of mine are referring back to this long sermon that he's just preached. Let me give you a quick survey of what was in that sermon. We could be here for years, as my Sunday school class knows, if we were to really study this sermon in some depth. It opened in verse 3 of chapter 5 with what we call the Beatitudes. It opens with a sketch of the kind of people who are really pleasing God. They're not the pushy, chubby, successful people the world admires. They are people who are humble, gentle, peaceable. They are mourning over the sin that's in their lives and in the world. They are people who long to be filled with true righteousness. These are the people that are the real salt of the earth, the real lights of the world. Jesus turns next to keeping God's law. What's it like to really keep God's law? Well, a lot of people think they do fine because they keep the externals. They didn't murder anybody. They didn't commit adultery. Give them gold stars. Jesus says, well, maybe you didn't murder anyone, but are you harboring hatred and resentment against someone else? Do you have contempt for somebody? You're in trouble with the murder law. He says, well, maybe you didn't really commit adultery, but are you going around full of lust? You might as well have broken the law, because inside you're an adulterer. Sometimes people are proud of themselves because they keep their word when they're under oath. What about other times? Betty was talking about truthfulness this morning. Okay. Jesus says your yes should be yes and your no should be no. Your word should be good as gold. And it shouldn't be when you take an oath and don't have your fingers crossed that that's when you tell the truth. You think you're pretty hot stuff because you love people who are nice to you and are good to them. That's not good enough. Everybody does that, don't they? Isn't everybody nice to people who are nice to them? What really matters is how you behave towards people who aren't nice to you. Jesus then turns to our religious lives. When we go to church and do things, what are we really doing them for? He spends half of chapter 6 on that subject. The rabbis of Jesus' day had a saying. They said, yes, God had hundreds of rules and regulations. That's true in the Old Testament. But there was a big three. And if you really excelled at the big three, you were guaranteed treasure. That's the word they used. One was almsgiving, giving money to help the poor. A second was praying, and the third one was fasting. So Jesus takes the big three. Everybody there knew that rabbi saying at the time. And he talks about why they're giving and how they're giving their alms. Trumpeters, no doubt, so that they make a big show and everyone sees how religious they are. What about their prayers? Wow, flowery orations and lots of repetitions and grand phrases and impressing others. How do they fast? Wow, they almost punish themselves to make it look a lot worse than it is. Jesus said they got what they were really after. They really impressed other people. Don't expect anything from God. And then he goes on to say, the real treasure, remember treasure was guaranteed from those, the real treasure shouldn't be on earth. The real treasure should be in heaven, where moth and rust do not corrupt and thieves do not break through and steal. And then he goes on and puts his eyes maybe on the poor people. You guys maybe think you're okay because you're not too worried about treasures and big bank accounts. But are you worried about where your next meal's going to come from and what you're going to wear? Well, that's a kind of worldliness too. And you can be corrupted by being so full of concern for worldly things, for the day-to-day kinds of difficulties we all face, that we squeeze the kingdom out of the way. He said, no, put the kingdom in first place. These things God will take care of you. Put the kingdom number one in your life. Then Jesus turns to the passage in chapter 7 that begins with, judge not, lest you be judged. He says something pretty uncomfortable. He said, the kind of rules we use when we're passing judgment on each other, think about this, God's going to look them up on judgment day and use them on us. Because the way we do the judging of others is how God is going to judge us. That's uncomfortable. And he goes on to talk about how we should have concern for each other, how we should treat one another. It's like God treats us. We ask for things, he gives them. We knock, he opens the door. Well, do that. Do that with other people who are seeking help. And he sums it up with the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's quite a sermon, isn't it? And it's after he said the golden rule that he sums up with the pictures I talked about. Well, there's no mystery what Jesus meant by the wise man. The wise man heard those words, and the wise man put those into practice. And there's no mystery about who the foolish man is. The foolish man heard those words and didn't do anything about it. Well, let's talk about the houses. They are a symbol too. I think the houses probably are meant to represent our visible religious lives, how our religion looks to other people. Jesus talks about that quite a bit. He had earlier talked about alms and prayer and fasting, and we each of us have a religious life. We're right here, aren't we? This is part of our religious life. We do things through the week. We do things at breakfast, and we do things at fun nights, and you name it. So that's what our houses are. Notice that both persons want a house. The wise person wants a house, but so does the foolish person, right? The foolish person is not the noisy atheist. The foolish person is the fake Christian, the superficial Christian who's not really trying to go deep. Both houses will probably do just fine in fair weather when you don't need a house much, right? So when you don't need a house, that's just great. Your external house without a foundation will be fine. What's different about the houses? Well, it's not the part you see. The part you see, why the foolish man's house might be prettier, right? It might be really something that would impress you. What's different about the houses is what they're built on. And this is why I had us also look at Luke's version. Matthew's version is kind of fuzzy as to where the houses are, but Luke's isn't. Okay. You know, here I think back to my long ago days as a child in a Methodist church down in southern Texas growing up. And I'm about to date myself seriously. They had something called flannel board talks. How many of you remember flannel boards? It's not 100%, okay? Well, I pray these days of electronic progress, we don't need them anymore. But in those days, we didn't have that. And so the person who gave the lesson for a visual aid would have usually a tripod thing that would open up. There'd be a big sort of a felty kind of a board, a flannel board. And they have pre-cut figures, and they would put them on there, stick them like Velcro on the flannel to tell the story. And I remember flannel board talks more than once in which we had this parable. And I remember how it went. You had the water lapping up here in the sand, right? Then you had the sandy bank, and then up behind them you had a mountain. And you know where the foolish man built his house? I hope it was at least high tide. Down there right by the water on the sand. And you know where the wise man built his house? Up in the mountain. That is not the picture. Look at Luke's version. The two houses in Luke's version, for sure, are sitting side by side on the same block, same street, same town. And it's not what you see that shows them apart. It's what's underneath. It's what's unseen. Anyone who does any building knows you need a foundation. You dig down. You make a footing, right? If you can go clear to rock, that's wonderful. But if you can't go clear to rock, you at least need something stable. That's why we go deep. Okay. If you were to just start putting up framing on the dirt, what would happen? I doubt it would last a couple of years. Okay, it's going to move all over the place. That is what Jesus is talking about. The foundations, I think, have two aspects of symbolism. One aspect is the internal versus the external. Or put it another way, the parts you see and the parts you don't. When you look at a house, do you see the foundation? No, you see all the externals. The other part is how long-lasting it will be, how secure it will be against difficulty. Well, that brings me to the storm. What does the storm represent? I looked at several commentaries, and they don't agree. Okay. On one side, you have a lot of commentators who say it means one thing, and on the other, you have a lot of commentators who say it means another. And when I think about it, I can't tell who's right, and maybe they're both true. Okay. So let me just share a little bit about both. Some commentators say the storm is meant to represent the final judgment. That's not a bad guess. After all, if you look at the sermon carefully, that's what Jesus has just been talking about. He's just talked about people in the final judgment coming up to him, quote, in that day, and saying, Lord, Lord, look at all the nifty things we did, you know. Don't we get all sorts of rewards? And he said, depart from me, you who work iniquity. You were not doing my will. So he's been talking about that in the breath just before this. That would be a thing in favor of this interpretation. It also fits the rock and sand symbolism, doesn't it? Whether or not it will endure forever versus whether it's going to collapse. Whether it's about what other people see versus what's true on the inside. The second picture, or the second interpretation of the storm picture, is that the storm is meant to represent the difficulties that you and I face day by day through our lives. Things that happened yesterday and will happen this afternoon and tomorrow. And in that case, it's not just about the final judgment. It's about whether or not our house is going to carry us through tomorrow, carry us through this following week that looms ahead. Notice that both houses are subjected to the same storm in the picture. It hits on both of them, but one of them stands and the other one doesn't. I say this too, this difference would be a good symbol of how we face earthly trials. Are Christians excused from earthly trials? If you've been a Christian a while, and most of you have, you know that isn't true. We face loss, we face disfigurement, we face illness, we face all sorts of terrible situations. Christians can lose their jobs too. Christians can have problems with children. Christians can have heartache. Now, Christians face the same storms as anyone else faces in this life. Fake religion, though, is going to collapse on you just when you most need a religion. When is it you most want a religion? Isn't it for the consolation, the shelter, that will carry you through the situation when these things happen? I think that when we think about the storms that life brings us, that Christians face as much as non-Christians, the list is probably endless. Okay. I gave some examples like loss and illness and hardship. We are all of us still struggling with things from the devil like pride and malice and resentment. Isn't that true? We want to get past it. God's working on us. We know it's wrong, but it's in there. And it's probably going to be partly in there till our dying day, and the total victory is won. No, those are hardships we face. We also face hardships about worldliness, worrying too much about wealth, about security, worrying about power, sensual gratification. We're bombarded with the same temptations that everyone else is bombarded with. Jesus, in another equally well-known parable, talks about the effects of these things on our faith house. I would like for you to look with me at the parable of the seeds. While a large crowd was gathering and people were coming to Jesus from town after town, he told this parable. A farmer went out to sow his seed. As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path. It was trampled on, and the birds of the air ate it up. Some fell on rock, and when it came up, the plants withered because they had no moisture. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up with it and choked the plants. Still other seed fell on good soil. It came up and yielded a crop 100 times more than was sown. When he said this, he called out, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." His disciples asked him what this parable meant. "This is the meaning of the parable," he said. "The seed is the word of God. Those along the path are the ones who hear, and then the devil comes and takes away the word from their hearts, so that they may not believe and be saved. Those on the rock are the ones who receive the word with joy when they hear it, but they have no root. They believe for a while, but in the time of testing, they fall away. The seed that fell among thorns stands for those who hear, but as they go on their way, they are choked by life's worries, riches, and pleasures, and they do not mature. But the seed on good soil stands for those with a noble and good heart, who hear the word, retain it, and by persevering, produce a crop. Well, I think we understand the parable, I hope now. What are the lessons in it for you and me right now? I think one conclusion we can draw is that we don't want to be fools. What are the marks of the fool that we've seen in this? Well, the modern fool is self-centered, right? All about me. How much of our culture is teaching that to us? Well, the modern fool is self-centered and views it as all about the self and its pleasures and its personal projects. The modern fool may well seek God's aid, but he's looking for God as something kind of like a fairy godmother. He wants God to come in and make his projects of a this-worldly kind go more smoothly. He goes to God not to learn from God what he should be, but to enlist God's help in things that he already wants for himself. The modern fool is concerned with appearances. What are other people thinking and saying about me? And does too many things with that kind of motivation. The modern fool is not really open to God's word. Remember Jesus said, "These words of mine." Isn't it nice when we read the Bible to be able to find so many words of comfort? Wow, all that stuff about grace and my burden is easy and come unto me who are labor and heavy laden, joy and peace. Wonderful. Did you ever notice that it's all mixed up with the same stern warnings and we skip right over that part often? We don't like the stern warnings. We don't like all of the stern talk about sin. And so what we tend to do is lift the things that make us feel good, push the other stuff off to the side. But I assure you that every reason you have for believing any of the assurances about grace and joy and peace is equally a reason to take seriously the warnings. They're said by the same Lord in the same passages with the same emphasis. So what would the modern wise man be like? Well, the modern wise man would not be self-centered. You'd care about other people. You would act with compassion and maybe even sacrificially to help other people when they're hurting. You would seek God's help to be a better person. You wouldn't be trying to bend God's will to your will. You'd be trying to build your will into something more like God's will. You're not worried about impressing other people. Let them think what they want. There's only one who matters. It's what God thinks in the end that will matter. The modern wise person will be open in a childlike way to the whole Bible, to the whole Word of God. Won't just pick and choose the comfort passages, but will also pay a lot of attention to the stern warnings. They have exactly the same authority behind them. We'll take sin seriously. We'll see sin as a melanoma at work in our lives. I think we could sum this up by saying that what we talked about today gives us a kind of a wisdom quiz, a self-answering wisdom quiz. And I think of it, too, as something that we can start today but take home with us. So maybe a take-home quiz. We can each answer for ourselves questions like this. Do I excuse or ignore my inner faults because I'm pretty active in the church? Think about it, you know. Well, I'm known for this and this and the other. But what am I like on the inside? 2, is my motivation really trying to please God? Or am I trying to just manipulate him into being my ally in some projects of my own making? 3, do I dwell pretty exclusively on myself? Am I always thinking about my own happiness, my own advancement? Am I going around with full of sense of entitlement, standing on my rights, by golly, you know, my rights really matter? Or am I putting all that aside? Am I trying to be like God? God who died for us while we're yet sinners. God who wants us to reach out to people and not force them to honor our rights, but to reach out in compassion to help them. Could my faith really withstand the kind of storms life brings? How would your faith do if you were to lose your job? How would your faith do if you were to lose a loved one? If you were to learn tomorrow that you have serious cancer, what would your faith do? When a person says, oh, this happened and now I can't believe in God anymore, it tells you that they built their house on the sand, doesn't it? If your house is on the rock, you don't say that. You trust the God who made us and will carry us through. Well, each of us have to answer these kind of questions for ourselves. You do, I do. And yes, we are saved by grace, but grace is not a license to snuggle up with the devil in the world. God doesn't save us in order that our old, sin-dominated lives are going to hum along a whole lot more prosperously than they used to. God saves us in order to change us. Let me repeat that. God saves us in order to change us, not to minister to who we already were. He wants to make us more like His Son. So if we're uneasy about our own answers to these questions this morning, well, then what we need to do is dig deeper. What we need to do is make a better foundation.
You've been listening to Dr. Steve Trammell at Hayes Christian Church. Hayes Christian Church is a non-denominational fellowship in Hayes, Kansas. We are supported by the generosity of our members, attenders, and friends. The financial support we raise goes to projects which further spread the gospel to those who do not yet know Jesus, to local, national, and international missions, and they help to keep these podcasts free. If you'd like to share a monetary gift with us, please visit our webpage at hayeschristianchurch.org and click on the Donate button. Or you may mail your gift to P.O. Box 1111, Hayes, Kansas 67601. If you have questions, comments, or would like more information, we would love to hear from you. Simply go to our webpage and click on the Contact Us form. Thank you for your generosity, and may God bless you as you seek to follow Him.